I'm with Paul Cooper, head chef at Bishop Cessa. Welcome to my informal chats on the website, Paul. You have a reputation in Melbourne of being a chef that's particularly passionate about sustainable produce, paddock to plate, nose to tail. Can you tell us about your philosophy in that respect?
For me, food is all about respect. You've got to respect the produce, for one. Respect the producer who produces it. And if you do those two things, then the end result should be something that the customer will be happy. So you've got to show the respect to the customer as well. I guess in terms of, we like to try and utilise the entire beast. So that's taking a nose-to-tail aspect, but in a different style as to what you'll normally see, where we get a whole beast in and we'll serve the tail right through the head. That's if it comes with the head on. That doesn't mean we specifically do offal, doesn't mean we specifically do, you know, briskets or secondary cuts. Sometimes there's primals, you know, we use the entire animal. And we word the menu as such, so instead of saying pork loin or lamb shoulder, we'll just word it as lamb or pork. Mm-hmm. And then that way we can utilise the cuts that we are up to on that particular animal. And it will help us, you know, show the different kinds of meats that you can put on the plate, or different cuts of meats that you can put on the plate, and different ways to cook them.
So what influenced you in that respect? What was the turning point for you?
I think I spent a lot of time overseas working with Shane, and we did a bit of whole beast butchery there, Pierre Terre. Not to the extent we do now, but he showed me that the, you know, showing respect for the produce is the utmost, is of utmost importance. And I think I just wanted to take it a step further and show respect to the entire beast rather than the best end that we were getting in. So the lambs, for example, would get the whole saddles in. And I often thought, well, you know, perhaps what's happening with the legs? Is someone using them, or do they end up in dog food? You know, but there's got to be, you know, a way to present the leg as well as you present the best end or the loin. So about trying to figure out ways to cook those cuts.
It's a more intensive practice for you, isn't it, as a chef in the kitchen?
There's a lot more labour involved. Obviously, we've got a butcher the meats on site. We don't get in pre-portioned meats or anything like that. We get the whole animal in. There's not one animal on the menu that does not come in whole at this current point, and we intend to keep it that way. And if we can, we will take it a step further and do more with it.
So there's benefits for the diner and yourself as well.
Correct.
As far as
I mean, we keep our prices very competitive, yeah. And we are able to keep them competitive because we get the whole beast in. And as such, we're paying a whole beast price rather than the overly inflated price for eye fillet, for example. So, you know, I've seen the Gundooie organic Wagyu that we get. I've seen that eye fillet for sale at $78 a kilo.
Right.
I can never afford to pay that. I can never afford to pay $78 a kilo. But what I can afford to do is pay for the whole side of Wagyu.
I guess it gives you an opportunity like tonight too, where we're here on a Tuesday night and you're doing three courses for $49.
That's right.
And I guess it gives you the opportunity to pass that through on a night like tonight.
Well, it certainly helps us maintain a certain amount of profit.
Yeah.
Certainly we don't make as much, but you know, what we are doing on the reverse side is getting a whole bunch of people in to experience what we offer.
Yeah, refreshing actually to see restaurants. I was walking up Surrey Hills tonight, absolutely full, which is heartening in the current environment.
It is. I mean, we Mondays and Tuesdays, we are full, you know, without fail. You know, Monday night we'll do 50, 60 covers. Tuesday night, as you see tonight, we'll pull upstairs and do another 20 downstairs, which is us, you know, with people at the bar and people in the windows.
Can you tell my readers about your move from Melbourne to Sydney? Because that was a big commitment for yourself.
Yep.
And what motivated that and your thoughts on how that's gone?
Well, clearly at the start it didn't go so well, but things have certainly turned around now. We are, you know, doing a very healthy trade at the moment. And I think as long as we keep our prices competitive and keep producing good quality food and interesting food, people will continue to come back. The move itself was prompted by the opportunity to open up this place for Therese. Therese is the man that I've had a lot of respect for when I was working with him in Melbourne. He moved up here about 12 months before I did. You know, we had a hiccup of having a child that slowed our move up here. So he opened up Bistro Bruno without me moving up here. And then, you know, I was talking to him, and he told me about this space. So I came up, had a look at it. We both agreed that it was a good opportunity, and we took it. So.
Any differences you've noticed as far as diners from Melbourne and Sydney, from your perspective as a chef to what you present to them, expectations or...?
Look, my opinion's changed over the 18 or 20 months now that we've been open. Initially, I thought the Sydney diner was a little bit more critical, perhaps. But I've, you know, since changed the way I think about that. I think they're a little bit more accepting as well of trying different things. A good example is the Wagyu Heart Tartare that we've got on the menu.
That was a magnificent dish.
Yeah.
Yeah, texture was perfect, balance, fantastic.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, that's one of the things we're trying to achieve. But that is a good example. So maybe four or five of those to the 20 odd downstairs and everyone upstairs.
I think that dish should be quite approachable too for someone having it the first time.
Look, it's not an overly confronting dish. You know, it is a raw meat, obviously. Yeah. But having said that, the flavours aren't terribly awfully, you know, it's got a really good meaty flavour, and as long as it's super fresh, the strength of the meat won't be too dominating. It'll be you can keep it quite mild, make the other flavours with it quite accommodating. So unfortunately I didn't put the new version. I think you've heard the new version because I didn't realise it was your table until a bit later on, but we're changing that a little bit tomorrow. We're putting a Grabiche ice cream onto it.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is, you know, it's a capers, cornichons, you know, they're really sharp flavours. Mm. All in an ice cream form. And it's it just adds another element to it, another cold texture. So it's
you mentioned working with Arez. Obviously, he's got a very strong background in wine and in service. Right at the top echelon of Melbourne, and he did at Bistro Bruno a lot of wine dinners and whatever. How do you find matching your food to, say, if a Rez did a wine dinner? Is that a challenge for you, or you collaborate together?
We certainly collaborate. We haven't done a lot of wine dinners. What we do is themed dinners, so we'll do a duck and pinot dinner, for example, or we'll do a pork and Riesling dinner. You know, so we'll get a theme going with the dinners. We're talking about what we'll do next. We're going to do a pork one next month, and beyond that, we're not sure. We might do a game one, but we'll always talk together about what wine he's hoping to get in, and what will go well with that. And he's pretty flexible with what wines he'll buy to suit the dishes, and I've got to be flexible with what I put on the plate. Even on the current menu, we alter a few dishes a little bit. That's not altering the authenticity of the dish or the nature of the dish, but it's altering some of the components just to help it match two different wines a little bit better. A good example is a kingfish on the menu. It goes really well with the sherry, but in order to make it go well with the sherry, we've had to put a bit more sorrel onto it, so, which helps. The lemonness of the sorrel, that sourness that's got, helps bring it together with the sherry. So, we work together, and I think it gives the customer a better experience at the end of the day.
It does, and
that's what it's about. We've got to get people happy. As long as they leave happy, they'll talk to their friends, and their friends will come in, hopefully. So
what do you see as the direction of Bishop Cesar? Where do you think you'll be taking it in the future?
I think it's refined, getting a bit more refined. I mean, we're in the process of finding more staff so we can improve things a little bit. We've done some work upstairs, we've done some work downstairs. We're going to keep improving it. So I guess by the end of when we're finished, what we'll have is it will never be a perfect restaurant, but it'll be a restaurant that I believe everyone will be comfortable coming to. It'll have a bit of interest to it. It'll be a bit... a bit funky, a little bit fun.
Yep.
I don't want a boring restaurant. I don't want it to be stiff. I don't want people to come in and feel comfortable. But I want them to have fantastic food. I want them to walk away going, that's some of the best food I've had.
Yes, you have, from my perspective as a diner, you have quite a deft touch with pastry and desserts. And where did that come from? Because, to me, it seems obvious to me when I first tasted your food, and I'm just curious as to how that...
I think a lot of chefs don't pay enough attention to pastry. I think it does. As long as you take the same process of the same philosophy with your pastries, you do with your main dishes, rather than saying, oh, we'll do a creme brulee, and we'll do a lemon tart, and, you know, I think as long as you put a bit of thought into it, work with the flavours, work with the textures, and I think they, it still can work. You know, we tried a lemon myrtle parfait today, which put some pineapple curd on it.
Yep.
You know, again, you know, it's not an uncommon combination, ice cream and curd, but we put some marshmallow over it, blow torch it, to give it a bit of that Australian campfire feel, you know, with the lemon myrtle, so you know, it's got a bit of an Australian dish feel. Good night, Alira.
Thank you so much. Super, thank you.
So, you know, we're working on dishes that have a bit of sense behind them. You know, you don't want them to be crazy creations. You want them to make sense on the plate and make sense in theory.
As far as how do you see your legacy as a chef? Obviously, with your nose-to-tail commitment, there'd be some people in your brigade learning that possibly for the first time.
Yeah.
Maybe all who have worked with you in the past. I mean, how do you see that?
I'd like to think that people come to me to learn, you know, different things and walk away from here a better chef than when they started. And if they're doing that, then, you know, it's going to reflect well on me in the future. And I think every chef that sticks with me is improved. They do improve. But, you know, there's a lot of work we put into the dishes, a lot of effort and energy goes into it. So I think these chefs will be a better chef for it. You know? I mean, they're learning how to run a business as well as, you know, how to cook. They're learning how to make the most out of each product and respect all the product as opposed to just the farm cuts.
That'd be an encouraging part for you seeing that, because it does concern me a little bit in the way food's going at the moment, that what you know, our young chefs will be learning, you know, as food has just been slowly sort of almost dumbed down to a degree. But it's good to see that someone's passing on those butchery skills.
Yep.
And also and cooking techniques. That concerns me a little bit. That's not being passed on. So
it's true. A lot of chefs nowadays are not happy to work more than 38 hours.
Mm.
And in order for them to do a 38-hour week, they're going to have to buy in portion cut meats. They're going to have to buy in portion cut fish, if not frozen fish. And then these things are, you know, I've been to venues like that. If I've ever walked into one to take it over as a chef, it doesn't last long. And those chefs who are doing that, they don't last long either. You know, it's an unfortunate thing. But, you know, I guess to agree, it's where food is headed. You know, in order to keep some chefs' hours down, they have to go down that road. And unless they're prepared to get the staff, spend time looking for the staff who are committed, then they're not really going to have any options. And unfortunately, that then breeds bad restaurateurs.
Yeah.
You know, restaurateurs who don't understand good food or where food comes from, and ends up being a bad cycle of unsustainable restaurants and serving unsustainable food.
It must have given you satisfaction when Bishop Sessa gained traction, because very early on it was a little hard, but there was must have been a turning point there when, I mean, I noticed it myself, you know, that it was about a year in, I found that it just, I could see it gaining traction. That must have been satisfying for you with the commitment you'd put into it.
We were, without a word of a lie, about 2 weeks from closing, we were $100,000 in debt and had no light at the end of the tunnel that we could see as how to get out of it, you know. But then we made a couple of small changes, you know, just to the personnel, had to cut some costs here and there, but we didn't change the food. We kept the food, we kept the wine list, we kept the product in place. And that in turn, because we believed in it, we thought what we were doing was a good thing, so we believed in it. And eventually, you know, our 20s became 30s, our 30s became 40s, and before you know it, we were doing 60 covers on a Friday night, Saturday night, and things were starting to look a bit healthy. You know, services started running a bit smoother because we were getting a bit more practice at it, and life started to get a little bit easier.
Yeah.
By no means were we out of the hole, but you know, come the end of the year, we paid off all our debts,
mm-hmm.
and So coming into last year, that is, we paid off all our debts. Now we're running in the black.
How difficult is it as a chef to keep focused during that period when you have outside factors putting duress on business? And how do you as a chef keep your focus during that time?
I guess you've got to believe in what you do. And we do believe that what we were doing is the right thing. You need some good people behind you, and people that you can turn to when you're having a bad day. We had some bad days,
yeah.
You know, but as long as you got that support team behind you, it makes it that little bit easier. And then when you're quiet, utilize your time. Don't run around thinking, oh, how bad is this? You know, utilize that time to come up with some new ideas, some better dishes. How can I use this leg in a better way? How can I sell heart?
Yeah.
You know, what can I do to heart to make it better? And you know, we try a whole bunch of things, and then you settle on a method that you think is the best one for what you're doing.
Well, congratulations, Paul, on firstly on the success of Bishop Sessa. Now that's taken, it's gained traction, and thanks for your time and this interview.
Ah, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, mate. Cheers.